somebody named Tian Sherman, it happens to be me. So that's the sort of thing, there's a whole bunch of numbers under there that represent the fingerprint of my BGP key. And if you know what to do with that, then you can use that for certain purposes. Otherwise, you can ignore that. Which, of course, most of all other things that I'll be talking about, you're free to ignore this stuff that I'm talking about. Because what you're getting is, well, let's see, you get two things. Two talks for the price of one. Isn't that wonderful? So what you're getting is a version of the useless use of star, which was a talk that I gave, that, as George mentioned, in 2007 at Scale in LA, and which recently came up on the mailing list, as some of you have seen, and there was some talk about AUG and SET and whatnot, and I was like, hey, I need to talk about it sometime, maybe you'll find this interesting, and it turns out people find it interesting. And when I was going over that, I didn't just want to give you a rehash of the old existing talk, I was going over that, and I was like, you know what, this can actually be taken a little bit further than just talking about shell and shell optimization, which we will talk about. And so you're getting a little bit more than that. You're getting the sneak preview of another talk I will be giving at some point in the future. So, does that, you get the best of both worlds, two talks for the price of one. Now, first of all, let's figure out who am I. Those of you who can read this very gray color there can determine that I'm clearly somewhat of a Unix person. So what we do here is we do a grep on FC password on the numeric ID of the current user, and we print out the field, which then is the Gecko's field, and happens to, like I mentioned, contain the full name. So there we are. This is my name. In addition, I belong, as most good Unix users know, to a certain number of groups. Group membership in the Unix world presents us here with the following groups. Alphabetically sorted. The first group being Etsy, which is my current employer, where I just started last week and which I'm very excited about. We do a lot of crafty things there, if you are into this sort of thing, and why wouldn't you, since you are here. You can go to code-craft.etsy.com, which is a very fine engineering blog. I also belong to a group called NetBSD, which is pretty much the only reference I currently have that relates this to this user group in any way, other than related to Unix. I am a member of the NetBSD developer group, but I have really not been doing a whole lot more lately. I used to do a lot more, I used to do a website, I used to do a bunch of package source things, and then I got a real job and I had a family, and all of a sudden I no longer had this time in the world for these kinds of things. But nevertheless, I still enjoy it. Thirdly, I'm in the group SA, System Administrators. My current job title happens to be Network Security Engineer, and before that I was a Principal Paranoid and I was a Systems Architect. But all these things fall into the group of system administration in my book. System administration is a very wide range of things, and I think many people of you probably also have system administration related tasks or even perform that job function. And finally, as a last group, I'm a member of the group Stevens, which happens to be Stevens Institute of Technology over in Oregon, where I get my master's from and where I am still teaching classes. I teach classes in system administration and I teach classes in Unix program. So all of this stuff, just to give you an idea of who I am, so you can choose whether or not you want to consider this of any value when you want to join. So let us go back, way back to the beginning. Back in the beginning.
Zoom in.
Zoom in? Oh, so we can do this. Look.
Does anyone know how to zoom up back?
Hold the control key and scroll up.
You're the one. That's
two fingers up.
Yes.
Hold the control key, two fingers up on the pad.
All right, let's put the microphone down for that.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, yeah. Awesome, I learned something today.
Good.
So, we're going back to the beginning. Back in the beginning, things were easier. You didn't have to use two hands to zoom into things because you didn't really have to zoom into stuff to begin with, right? We were talking about text terminals and things like that. And we had this wonderful world where you could spend all sorts of time running away the hours during working hours or late at night, which is called the Usenet. I love the Usenet. I spend a lot of time there. Who here has been spending a lot of time on Usenet?
Recently?
Not recently, I'm glad enough. So, okay, there's a handful of hands here, very good. The usenet was really wonderful, I thought. It was a nice text medium where people had discussions. And these usenet messages later on were also available. You could search them, and now they were eventually the Deja News archive was bought by Google, but you can still search them, which is kind of nice. So, in usenet, people have discussions. On usenet, people are wrong on the internet, which happens a lot, right? And when someone is wrong on the internet, you have to correct them. So you spend a little bit of time.
Is it like Facebook or something?
It was similar to Facebook, only without the face and without the book, more text and messages. So it was discussion groups. So back then, people sent text messages that looked something like this. They gave it an apt subject line, such as search and destroy, which clearly tells you what this user might be interested in. And they pose a question, for example, to the news board content shell. The question is, I have a bunch of text files that contain a certain string, and I want to get rid of this string, a certain substring. What should I do? Should I use arg? Should I use sed? Somebody please help me. And as you know, people on the internet are always helpful. So he has the first person who responds and says, hey, here you go. This is how you do this. Cat file into set dash e and then substitute every slash u for nothing. And this is actually already one of the first things that people who nowadays play with set may not even know. You can use any kind of character to separate whatever pattern you're looking for, right? You don't have to use a slash, which makes it cumbersome if you are looking for a slash because then you escape, right? Anyway, so we have this command which solves the problem nicely, but sometimes when people are on the internet and they're helpful, sometimes they're wrong.
Yeah.
And then enter Nolan. You don't know how many people might know this fellow friendly face over here in these kinds of hands. Who knows? Randall Schwartz. Alright, there's a few people. Just another Perl hacker. He has been around on the internet for a long time, has been involved in a number of interesting events and cases, and you can read up on that a whole lot. He was the person who coined the term useless use of cat. His response was, okay, here we go, this week's useless use of cat award goes to Herman, who said, cat file, pipeset, which uses the simple rule that anything that consists of cat fret, pipe, barney, junk, junk, junk can be written as redirect fret, barney, junk, junk, junk. In this case, redirect file, sets, actually, and so on and so on. This is the best as I can tell. Excuse me. This is the best as I can tell the earliest reference to the phrase the useless use of cat, which Randall Schwartz did invent. And he then gave out on this Unix user group on a weekly basis or so, sometimes more frequently, to people who said, oh, I'm using cat or I'm using some other tool in a way that is not particularly efficient. He says, this is useless. You don't have to invoke cat over here. You can do this without this. So this was the invention of the useless use of cat.
Can you give me more?
I will put down my hand again.
Let's see
if this is sufficient. Alright, so this was the first useless use of cat, very obvious. So that then gets you to the question of what exactly is the useful use of cat? Why do we have cat as a tool, right? We have a couple of very obvious examples. We have cat file type grep pattern, or cat file into org and print some string. Doesn't matter what the input really is, just matters that you say you want to invoke this one tool on this input. As you may know, Unix was initially written to follow certain principles, and one of them is that you always operate on a text interface, where you have text streams going in, and the next tool can process that, and then spits that out to standard out, so the next tool can further process that. Cat itself is used to concatenate files. It just cats the file, it reads from standard in, and writes to standard out. So if you give it a file, it reads from the file, and prints that to standard out. But this is not particularly useful in this case, as we have seen. Those tools can actually use this input in a different way. So we declare that this is another useless use of cat. This is not how we use cat. Because what we can do, what we just learned in the previous example, we can just redirect standard out in the shell with the shell meta character less than, and thereby feeding the input into the command. This, the shell itself, has a mechanism to open a file and read it line by line and feed it into a tool. So, in this example, we go to this. I will also accept this as a solution. Well, we don't do the redirection because many of the Unix tools also just accept an argument. So you don't even have to do the shadow redirection because say, hey, give me this thing. Or likewise, as we saw in Merlin's example, you can actually put this at the beginning or at the end of the command. This is one of those things where people always say, you know what, I like to use cat in my pipelines so that I always have cat at the beginning and then my rolling pipeline over here and over here and over here. If you are using Unix a lot, then obviously if you are writing a command, you frequently start out with one command and then you add a new filter. And then you say, oh, this is not quite what I want, to add a new filter at the end. So you want to have your pipeline in order. So the cat at the beginning is useful, but you don't need it, you can even put the redirection of the shell at the beginning. So, how about this then? Is this a useful use of cat? Here we have not just one file, but multiple files. And we're counting lines, or in the second example, we're counting the individual words of those files that we have. So what happens here? If you know the WC command, it can take as argument a file when it was standard in. If it takes a file, well, how do you make it count lines in multiple files? Okay, it can do that. It can iterate over the files. But it will give you an output that looks like number file 1, number file 2, number file 3, and then finally the total. Which is not the same as saying, I want the total number of those things. If you wanted that, you'd have to further post-process them. So we say this is logical. So maybe cat is a useful example here to do that. Well, I declare that this is another useful use of cat because we can just run this with a different command. We can run this with awk, and then we can say awk, as you may have learned in one of your previous lectures here. It's very complicated. It's not complicated. It's more complex than people think. You can do amazing things with it. And one of the simple things you can do is just not process everything and not print anything and just go to the end. And when you're at the very end, you can print how many lines you've got, and then you're done with it. If you want to count the words, you can also use awk for that and say, hey, as I'm iterating over every line, get count the words, how many there are. And then I'll print that out over all the files and you'll also get the result. Of course, there's always more than one way to do it, right? So we have multiple useless uses of cat, and in this case, the awk thing might just be done in a different way, right? Some of you people say, oh, no, I don't like awk, or I use awk. You can use set if you like, and there you go. Set can do the same thing. And set is also more versatile than people think. Most of the time, people use set to substitute one thing for another, but set is actually fairly flexible to do other things. In this example, it just doesn't print anything, and at the very end, it prints out the number of records that it will see. So the word counting, that is meant as an exercise for you guys if you choose to do so. Alright, even more useless use of cat. So, we've already seen the grab thing. Suppose you want to actually grab on multiple files. Cat might be useful for this because then you have all one input stream and you can grab them out. Instead of getting grab where you then say grab multiple files, it will give you prefixes of the file name plus the results. You might just be using the results. Or you might do this in a shell program where you say, okay, I have to check whether or not there are any of these patterns. So you can, you know, count how many there are. If the count happens to be larger than zero, then you can follow the if commands. And no, not very surprisingly, we also call this useless use of cat because grep has another option to do these things. And if you're actually running in a shell, you can actually cut out the cat over here and put it into grep L, which then lists the files that are matching, and if that returns a non-zero string, you can proceed in the loop. Or, there's more than one way to do it, right? You can also just use that way. If you can use grep, you can also probably use R, where you just print the certain things. Or, in the last part, you will notice that we're getting significantly shorter and easier in our logic, right? In the first if statement that is crossed out, we actually spawn a subshell where we have a pipeline into grep and then do a comparison. In the second example, we are doing a subshell that grabs something and then do a string comparison versus an empty string. And finally, in the last one, we're just running a command and looking at the exit status of the command. And this is an example of how we're trying to approach this, how we're trying to get things a little bit simpler. We're trying to reduce the number of commands we're using and use the tools to their fullest extent as far as Unix provides them to us. So Unix provides us with a tool. It has certain flags, it has certain clamping options that allow us to actually access these things and make them simple. And finally, the last example, the if case, also reads a lot easier than the previous one. Alright, now that we know that we have all these useless use of cat, why do we even have cat? And what is it even useful for? Well, for starters, it can do exactly what it says it does. It can concatenate files. So you can actually have multiple files and say, okay, I'm going to have all these files combined into one file. And there's a very simple way to do this. You do a cat, you let the shell expand the star into whatever files you have, and all of them will then be appended in the order that the shell presented them in one file, which can be useful. It is also useful if you actually have to rely on a certain order of input. So for example, we have over here a subshell that says first we have an echo command of a certain variable, then we have a cat of a file, and then we run some sort of command. And we want to feed all of this in this specific order into another command. So I want to create a pipeline where the command on the right-hand side takes us in from these three things in a very specific order. And then the cat can also be useful to actually insert it here and say, okay, this echoes in the variable, it caps the file, it runs command 1, and the output of all three will be sequentially fed into the next command. Or, and this is something that I like, which works well if you're doing more than just simple programming in shell, which, even though many people are poo-pooing the very idea, happens a lot every now and then. So suppose you have this kind of construction, this kind of conditional loop, which happens to me a lot, where you say, okay, I have a condition, and I run one pipeline, and possibly under a certain other condition, I have a second pipeline. Now, those two look very similar, only in one case we have a command that goes in between. Any time that I'm writing code, where I'm writing twice the same code, that's a bad idea. If I write twice the same code, it probably goes into a function or something. If it's almost the same code, then I have to think about, wait a second, next time I update this, what if command 3 changes? Now I have two places where I have to change this. I'd rather not have that. I'd rather have only one place where I change that. So what I can do is I can just assign a variable, a program name to a variable, and then use that as the filter. So I then have an if then else statement that selects my filter, and then I say, okay, command 1 goes into filter, which goes into 3, which in this case then may be the new command 2, or it may be cat, which is a null, effectively. So if cat copies input from standard in to standard out, you can just use it as a null. Those are some useful uses of cat. This is not the exhaustive list, mind you, there are other useful uses, but there's some of them. Here, there's more useful use of cat. We've got cat 5 and we've got cat 6. Now cat 5 nowadays is not quite so useful anymore, right? Anyway. So why do we bother with arrows? Right? We have this stupid little command called cat, and we're giving like this whole long talk about it, we're thinking all other things about why do we bother about eliminating this one piece of code that we have there? Why is this important? Well, I like to think about the cost of a fork. If you are running shell scripts, you will always run them frequently, routinely, regularly, and depending on what kind of input you have, or depending on what kind of infrastructure you have, you may run it a lot of times. Every time you shell out and you have a cat in there, your shell has to fork and exec another system call, maybe another system call fork, then exec itself with a cat executable, load the executable into memory, and run this. This has a certain cost. In this example, about $2.95. Now, you don't do this just once. You do this frequently. If you have your same shell script or multiple of those, eventually the costs add up, right? Suppose you actually are running a lot of shell scripts and you have a medium-sized compute deployment, it actually adds up to a certain number. Now, me, I've been running at a fairly large size where if you run inputs, you will likely be running this interface across hundreds, thousands, or hundreds of thousands of hosts. And if you actually can save one single fork across hundreds of thousands of iterations, it actually adds up to noticeable time. You will realize that if you are cutting out a certain number of executions, you can reduce the overall execution time of your computer. In my example, I've been able to actually reduce the tool that took several hours to run to less than an hour by slowly, slowly optimizing certain things. Not only cutting out execs, but also doing that. And this is what it was. Alright, so now we know that text was stupid, right? But that is not really everything. I mean, there must be more to this. No, useless use of cat has this significance, it has a certain heritage, and it speaks to more than just, you know, individuating those poor felines. No, rather, it is more about thinking what kind of tools you have and when you use them efficiently. So, I came to think, what would be a useful, useless use of graph then, if we actually have cat? Well, first of all, if you think about graph, all of graph is useless. You don't need graph at all. As you may know, grep is not actually an acronym, but grep was derived from the old command for the ed editor. Ed is the Unix editor, as you all know, and this is how you use to print out lines that match a certain regular expression. You add globally, looking for a regular expression, and then you print it. If you put this into ed, and there you go. Now, obviously, this is not quite the right end. So, this is something that I see a lot. You probably see this a lot too. I even write this a lot. You start out doing something, and then you're interested in only a subset of the strings. So you have a host name, you have a host name lookup, and then as you know, host name or the host command will probably print for you more than just the host name. It will also probably print for you the MX record if it happens to be there by default. So you say, okay, I'm only interested in the has address line, and I want to print only the address. So basically you want to say, if I have a host name, I want to print the IP address. And this is something I see a lot. Not just the people doing it, but even in vendor shell scripts. People that write shell scripts to install commercial software, who knows what, I see this a lot. Likewise, in the second example, you have something similar where you have a string that you have somehow produced, in this case a vacuum, then you are searching for a certain pattern, and once you have that string that only contains this pattern, you perform some substitution on it. All very common standard Unix tools and all very good examples of how extensible Linux is and how we use the tools normally, like building this little pipeline for building Java in general. Well, this is the useless use of grep. Well, first of all, why do we have a grapefruit then? Anybody know? It's not a grapefruit. So I was searching for things related to grep, and for some reason, all these pictures of grapefruit show up. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Until somewhere I realized that these pages that show this up were in a different language. Apparently, the Czech word for grapefruit is grep. So it's not very surprising that I was in a grep pages. Anyway, so useless use of grep will be the first case. And this is one of the canonical examples. You see this everywhere, and you probably use it a lot, or you've seen it anywhere, where it is pipe grep, pipe awk. There's no reason for you to use grep in there. Awk can match your pattern too, you know? So awk is pretty flexible, and you can say things like, hey, only operate on lines that are matching a certain regular expression, in this case, as an X. Likewise, set also can match regular expressions, and then operate only on those lines. You can say, you know what, instead of always printing all lines, don't print any lines, match n, and then match this pattern, and if this matches, perform the next operation, in which case the substitution here, and print that line. That would then save us the invocation of grep in this example. How about this one then? Is this a useful use of grep? I see this a lot too. I'm sure you use it a lot. Where you say grep something, and then, oh yeah, but I don't want that. You want to say, you know, this, but not the other. Grep this, grep me that. Now it's the look at us. Is that useful? Or if you say grep one thing, then not grab the second thing, and not grab the second or third thing. So you try to make your query more complex, with multiple implications and grep. I declare this a useless use of grapefruit. We can just say, awk, match the pattern, and not match another pattern. There is nothing to do, you can go ahead and do that. Or you can go a little bit more complex, which shows you just how awk can also treat multiple regular expressions, much like any other of the programming languages that you may know, such as Perl or Python or whatnot. You are not particularly limited in what you can do in your matching. You can just say, not this, not followed by that, and so on and so on. This is my all-time favorite, right? See this all the time. What do we do here? We are looking for the process ID of a specific command, right? Most of the time it's something like, oh, then also feed into x args kill or something like that. So You want to say, I want to terminate all the processes, this thing. And the problem is, if you terminate all the processes mentioned commands, your string grep command will show up in the process table, you terminate by 0, and you're not actually getting all the processes. So you say, that is why I would execute grep. And there you go, this is what everybody does. And that's also a very common interview question for pretty much any Unix position, right? People are like, okay, what we do with this, is this really useful? No, it is not. The easier or better way to do this would be just using this kind of syntax. Who here knows what this does? One, that's it?
I know what it does, I don't know why.
Okay, that would be the second question, of course. So, that's something, you know, I post this question in an interview and someone has said, oh yeah, I have to put these brackets in there. I said, very good. What this does is, well, what is it? Oh, it causes me not to actually match this command. Yeah, that is correct, but why? How does it do that? Well, the question is, in what order are these things executed and what shows up in the process table? Yes, we can ignore. We know that this shows up in the process table as is, we are interested in that. We're interested in the second part, grep command. We say grep for anything that starts with a character class of the letter C and then it ends the character class. As you know, a character class could be multiple characters, sometimes even ranges, A through Z, 0 through 9, or just F, G, N, and X, or something like that. In this case, it happens to be C, followed by the string MD. The shell, after invocation, parses this and says, okay, this character class represents exactly one of those things, namely C. Therefore, the shell will expand this as grep C and D, but the process table contains grep bracket C, closing bracket MD, which is why if you then are looking for processes that match this, your individual process will not actually be in the process table matching and you can actually proceed in killing those things. This is another thing that I think is very important to actually understand where in the shell execution certain things take place. When do things get expanded? In what order do they get expanded and in what order do things get searched? Because then you can actually make things more efficient as you go along. Here's a useful use of grep. This is a grapefruit beer by Shiner Breweries.
This is
I actually haven't tried it, but I would probably like it. I mean, I like wheat beers, as you can tell, with lemon or any other citrus beer. The grapefruit, of course, is actually spliced together from an orange and a pomelo. Pomelo, the Spanish word for grapefruit, is not actually a pomelo. It is an English fruit named pomelo. I didn't know that. Anyway, so then I went on, okay, we got grape covered. We have a couple of those examples. What about sedge? We see sedge all the time, people use sedge a lot. Yes, I think we are looping over something. We want to loop over the contents of the path variable. But as you know, the path variable gives us all these different locations where we look for executables separated by colon. Colon separation being a fairly common theme in the Unix world, for example, the ESC password database is also colon separated. It's an easy text format that you can use. So we have, for a variable, these lists of locations where we look for executables. Now in this case, ls just happens to be a command where we list all these different ones, and it doesn't really make a difference which command there is. The point is we're looping over each individual path in a variable and operating on it. Since we don't want to operate in this one gigantic string with all these colons in between, we're stripping out the colons using the set. We say, okay, replace the colon with the space. Is this useful? Well, no. We can use this in a different way. We can put away with this extra process of the set. We will get to the question why there's a couch there in a minute. What you can do is, we can again try to understand what the shell does. The shell has something known as the internal field separator, or IFS variable. The internal field separator is one of these variables that by tradition lots of Unix tools honor. They operate on it and they say, okay, if I see a character that falls into this number of focus in this variable, I will pretend that a new field has started. So for example, if you have arc, arc will operate on fields. Other tools operate on fields too. Normally in the environment, space, white space, because the students are there. And normally we don't distinguish either between regular space and tap and all these things we're just saying, all sorts of white space for the field separator. But we can say, you know what, for this little command that we're running here, place the field separator to read a character colon. In which case, looping over something separated by colons will actually iterate all these individual pieces, and you don't have to fork another process for this. Notice that this is all within the shell. The loop is within the shell, there's an extra process. The only process responding is the one you have to anyway for the command that you're running. Now, why do we have a couch here? Well, the first time I gave this talk and I looked for grape, I didn't come up with a grapefruit. I came up with a chair. A chair that looked like a chair I used to have at home, which I bought at IKEA. And I looked it up, and look at this. In the IKEA catalog, there was a chair called grape. The trick to think about is a fairly IKEA kind of name. Then I realized, oh, wait a second, let me search the IKEA catalog for scent. And guess what came up? The couch. In IKEA, a couple of years ago, wasn't even scent. And I realized, you know what, IKEA has all sorts of things that you can, you know, these names are probably just taken from the Unix system. They just went through, then let's use a pen and started naming stuff, right? So for example, we have something called, sounds like a pretty good name for a chair for me. We have Schlock. Schlock seems like a good tool. We had Route, which seems reasonable. And of course we have the value of this double. But anyway, so this is why we have the couch there. Now, here we have something that is a useful use of set and declare. What is this and what does it do?
Yes. Can you go back to the previous code? That's it. Okay. What would happen if you dropped the semicolon the first one?
If you drop the first semicolon, right, it would still
some work. Shells, the IFS would be linked to the next command.
Yes, that is correct. It is a question of how variables are treated. You may, depending on the shell, have to use env to actually export this into the environment of the running command, or you can actually set it. This is two separate commands on one line. You can also prefix any command with just a variable assigned that only holds for this particular command. So there are different variations there. In this case, I put the semicolon there just for clarity to say that these are two distinct commands rather than just this one thing that belongs together.
The problem is that the IFS this is one of the most dangerous things you can do.
To manipulate the IFS.
And the scope of that is going to continue after that command.
That is correct. You have to do it.
And so you always please everyone when you do this trick, you must save the old value and restore
exactly.
It immediately.
Exactly. So this is, you know, just typing on the command line and then you can reset this. In commands, what a convention is to have a variable called lowercase o IFS, for example, where you assign initially the value of the internal field separator to a separate variable, then you set it, and then after you're done manipulating whatever it is you're doing, you reset IFS back to the old internal field separator, which, as you point out, is very important because otherwise the next command you're running, if you have a while loop that tries to read over lines, it will no longer work as you expect. Absolutely correct.
I'm setting on the positioning name value. Does that actually work for built-ins? Four is an execution, it's a built-in.
Right, and that's correct.
So does the actual witness anyone work for built-ins?
Yes, it works for the following two. The shell, in the current process of the shell, will assign this variable, and whatever it runs will still honor that environment. Since you know, in the Unix world, you cannot manipulate your parent's environment, you cannot actually change anything that after it has terminated has an influence on the rest. So the built-ins must, by definition, honor the environment as it's being set, because otherwise you would have to manipulate the parent process environment, which you can't do.
No, but if you just said, so if you took the semicolon out in that example, since you're not executing that being exposed to the environment of the next command.
Yes.
The parent environment, which is the environment.
Which is the current environment.
Okay. Right, so that wouldn't persist after the world?
I'm not sure.
If the semicolon there, it will persist. If you didn't use the semicolon, most of it, I think,
most cells
that
should
will revert after the command chain.
Right, that's what I think too. I think that's the semicolon tells the shell this is explicit, and the other one says it's internal. That probably depends on your particular flavor of the shell. Right, so those are the easy examples and all your questions. And I was going to ask you about this whole thing next. Now this is a set program. As you may know, you can do lots of things in set. You can manipulate strings, and just the other day I happened to come across this particular thing, which I thought was a fairly elegant solution to a problem where somebody said they wanted to perform arithmetic using set. And you think set is a string editor which operates on strings, how can you do arithmetic on that? Well, you can if you follow what it actually does. And it replaces individual numbers with single characters and then counts them later on how many there are. And so you can actually do plus and minus in this program. So you can pipe something like 10 plus 5 in there and you will get out 15. Obviously, that is not a useful use of your time, but nevertheless, it is kind of interesting in trying to understand the things you can do if you're doing that.
This is even more elegant in assembly language.
Yes.
Have you seen
Spectrus? Well, someone that's actually driven set. Oh no, I've seen the Towers of Hanoi done in set, which is included in the original set distribution and in the DSPs, they have it actually under user share or whatever. Which is fun to play. In one of my classes I play this in the class and it's set operation of A, B, C, D, and it has to stack them Tower of Hanoi kind of one up, probably always in the higher. And I once started running it across the entire alphabet, so 26, and it took me over 4 days for it to actually complete this, because guess what, this is a fairly high algorithm complexity. But anyway, let us go back to what may or may not actually be a useful use of set. This is another instance of things that I have encountered in shell scripts. Every now and then you have a variable that contains more than one value, and it is separated by some sort of thing. In this case, it's a dash. And so you see this frequently, you say, okay, first I rip out the first part, then I rip out the middle part, and then I rip out the last part, and assign to each of my three variables the first, second, and third thing. And this is something that most people would probably start writing if they were asked, can you produce these three variables in from the one variable? And so the first thing, if you know shell, you know that the shell can also treat variables in a specific way. It can actually expand variables. And even the born shell does have certain shell expansion modifications, but you have certain patterns where you can match substrings. The percent over here says match the longest substring starting from the end, where you have something that follows a dash. So it starts on the right hand side and greedily goes to the left hand side, trying to remove all things until it finally hits the dash. Which in this case will assign the value through to bar A. So you can do this. Likewise, you can go in the other direction. You can manipulate variables by expanding them from the beginning. In this case, it's the longest match starting from the beginning, same logic, greedily moves from left to right until it hits the last dash, and then strip that off, and you are ending up with bass. But the thing in the middle gets kind of tricky. And you think, you know what, if I can't do the first and the second, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can have one variable, then expand the first part, and then another one expand the second part. And this would be nice if this worked, but it doesn't. So you actually cannot do that. If you do this, most shells will give you a bad substitution error. Now, some shells can do something like that. For example, ZSH is, I think, able to actually do nested expansions, which is fairly expensive to implement if you are the person writing the shell, and probably makes you think recursively about all sorts of stuff. But the born shell and even bash doesn't do that, so you cannot do that, as you say. But what we just said is, hey, wait a second, if we have something that is separated by a certain three fields separated by a value, then perhaps we can use again the IFS variable. IFS, if we set this to dash, then we should be able to iterate over this and assign it. Now, you can do a for loop and then dynamically eval the variable to become another variable's name, but that's too messy. The cleaner solution is to set the positional parameters in the shell. The shell has positional parameters, so these are the arguments that are given. Normally you see them at the beginning of a command as the command line arguments, or related to whatever Perl or Python, whatever you use in the RV. So you can actually get RV0, RV1, etc., etc. You can set these positional parameters from another variable. If you have a variable containing certain fields, you can say, you know what, from now on, declare, or rather stuff these things into your RV, so to speak. And then you end up with this. So you set internally the positional variables to symbol bus with an IFS set to dash, and then you have 1, 2, and 3 immediately expand to these kind of things. All right, then you say, hey, look at this. This IFS thing is really particularly useful. Let me use this for all sorts of things. For example, I can read a comma separated value with IFS, right? Because comma separated values suggest we have one field, different fields separated by one value into a comma. So if you set the IFS to a comma and then we loop over this, we can actually do these things. So we can have such as read into these variables, and you can, you know, discard certain things called release, and then say, okay, I get the first field, I get the fourth field, and I get the third field later on. It doesn't really matter what this particular transformation does. It's just an example of saying I can process the individual comma separated things and use them. And this will work. However, I declare this to be a useless use of IFS. And this happens to be a band called the IFS. This is a useful use of IFS because if you take the time to actually run this across a significant amount of input, you will realize that this is not particularly fast. So we have a file here that has a large number of lines, all comma separated values, and if we run this, this took me like over 12 seconds. Now, in the grand scheme of things, 12 seconds, hey, nothing, right? If you're sitting at a terminal waiting for a command to finish, 12 seconds is a really long time. By that time, you're long gone on Facebook and have done all sorts of other stuff and forgotten about what this terminal was doing. So this is particularly slow. Well, why is this slow? Well, if you're looping over something and the shell has to actually perform the reading action, the shell has to look at every character that comes in and then evaluate whether or not it happens to be a shell meta character, whether or not it manipulates the environment, etc., etc. It can't just slip it into a buffer and process it. It has to read every single character and then possibly change its behavior based on that, which makes it fairly slow. So sometimes it may actually be much more advantageous to use a separate tool and not be inside the shell. So in this example, you can of course do the same thing with R or with set or whatever other tool you may have, right? In this example, this took me in pure shell without forking anything, 12 seconds, when in about 1 second if I use it with R. And this is another illustration of you cannot always have your one big hammer. You cannot just treat everything as being able to be solved with a certain approach. You have a number of problems that you can solve in one way, and others have to be solved in a different way. Even though we say, okay, we can reduce the number of executions in the subshell, we may actually become more performant. Sometimes we do not. Even if you are not performing any additional forking execs, you may actually run slower than just forking up to a tool that is particularly good at doing a certain task. How about LX? This is another thing I see a lot in poorly written vendor codes most of the time. When you loop over something, you say, hey, I want to loop over all the files in the current directory that match this particular pattern. So here we loop, we fork a subshell, we invoke ls, and we hand to ls star pattern star. Now this is, of course, a useless use of ls, which is the name of the model of the shoes, as I found. I've seen people wear the shoes. They look interesting, more comfortable. And the name LS, that's what they do. Anyway, so first of all, we can put away with the whole subshell there, and we don't even need LS at all, right? Why is that? Well, what you're doing is whenever you spawn the subshell, you invoke LS and hand it star, pattern, star. What expands star, pattern, star? It's not LS. LS gets a list of arguments. It gets them from the shell. The shell will look at star, pattern, star, expand it to all the files that match the pattern, and hand it to LS, which then proceeds to hand them to you again. So you can cut that out and actually just have for file and install pattern, which will do exactly the same thing, only much more efficiently.
And so you have space in your calling.
Which you can still do in this case, then you just have it as a question of how you proceed to process them. You then have to quote them, for example. If you quote your individual files in the lower one, it should work. Because the shell is expensive, is ignorant about whether or not the name happens to have a space in it. The space only becomes significant in the next step of the processing, where you try to say, oh, I will feed this variable value to something else. It only happens that this variable value contains a space, and therefore looks like two things to this other thing. If you code that, then the next thing that you'll know that it's only one. But the shell itself has no problem iterating on the next thing.
So that would be a problem either way.
I think it's actually worse than the ILS case. How about WC? We've already seen in the beginning WC where we want to count something. And here we have the case not just when we do this on the command line, but when you do it programmatically. And all the examples of things I've seen in code that I found in various production environments or have been handled by other people. So we see somebody get a file, count how many lines there are. And now the problem is when you run WCL, it prints it with a tab. And then all you just look at your number, right? And they say, oh, I don't want to have this tab over there. I'll just replace it with sets for the white space and strip it off, right? Well, first of all, we know from the beginning that this is used as use of cat, right? We don't need to read this. We can just do double CL on a redirected file. The reason that we, in this case, have to redirect and can't just give file as an argument is that if WC is given an argument, it will say number followed by file. You are only interested in the number, so we actually have to do the redirect there. But you still have the white space to do this. Well, I declare this to be a useless use of both WC and Z, and you can just use awk, for example, and you print the number of lines as we've seen previously. Just, there's always more than one way to kill the cat. We also find the useful use of WC, in this case by the cat. Because you can still do the redirect of the WC, and then, as we just mentioned, the shell behaves differently based on how it treats variables, whether they're coded or not. If they're coded, they retain white space. So if you operate on the variable var and you have the variable coded, then the variable will, to all the other tools, seem as white space followed by the line number. If you don't code this, then the shell will effectively strip off the white space and you just end up with one token, since the IFS happens to be white space, it will show up as one token, which is only the number of things. So the question of whether if you code a variable may influence how it's being processed, it's useful to be aware of that. How about head? Well, if you get this thing, we say, okay, give me the first line of whatever the output is produced, and then replace something. Or give me the first 10 lines, or any variation thereof. Well, not very surprisingly, we have a useless use of that. This picture was a lot more up-to-date than the last game this talk in 2007, which was following the 2006 World Cup, which is where Zinedine Zidane did the headbutt. Exactly. Nevertheless, France won the World Cup in that year. But this is soccer, this can be people who care about this. Anyway, so we've got this command where we pipe something into head and then we process it. Now we can also just stop processing on the first line until it says, you know what, once you've done your first thing, quit. And said being a happy quitter will do it for you. Or you can operate on a certain number of lines and you can say, you know what, do this, but once you've processed 10 lines first. So you can actually do multiple of these things and not have to involve it. Yes?
Let me just point out, this is very useful if you're using sed, the semicolon Q, that putting multiple commands.
Yes. Frequently what people do is they pipe into multiple sed invocations sometimes, but even that may not always be what exactly you want. Because then you have to change whether or not you're printing something instead versus whether you're not printing. So actually being able to have a second command followed by it is very useful. If you actually are more fluent instead, you can branch out here and build level programs that were written, apparently, on the towers of Hanoi. That would be useless. Now, obviously, we're talking about head, we have to talk about tail, right? What does tail do? Tail goes to the very end of the file and effectively seeks back until it finds the last carriage return and prints out whatever came from them, if you put it on your runline or in lines or whatever. It is something that I always like to assign to my students to implement because it actually requires you to think about how this actually does that thing. It's not that trivial. Nevertheless, so we get the last line of whatever the output is, and we say, okay, it's up to do this. Or we get the last 10 lines. The first thing, I declare to be a completely useless use of tail, because you can again just tell set to do this. You can just say don't print anything, and only on the very last line perform this operation and print the last line, and it will do that. Alright, so this is the last line. How about the last 10 lines? This is a little bit trickier. Because over here, you have to say, okay, go to the end of the file, and then go back 10 lines and do that. You can come up with a pipeline that does that in other things than using tail, but it gets very, very messy because then you actually have to perform the same work. You can pipe this into awk, keep a buffer of 10 lines, and when you hit the last line, go back and print those from your buffer. Now this is not particularly efficient and very, very messy once you write it out. So this is something I actually consider to be a useful use of tail. You can actually do certain things with the tools that they're designed for, because they have a purpose after all. So, what I've been talking about really relates somewhat to shell performance. I'm a person who does a lot in the shell. I write a lot of code in the shell. As I said, oftentimes people say, oh, no, no, once you're reaching more than 100 lines, you should write in Perl, or in Python, or in Ruby, or in whatever the latest phase is. That may be nice, but you cannot always do that. I have been in systems where we had to rely on the lowest common denominator. We did not know whether or not all of our hundreds of thousands of systems had a specific version of Perl installed, or had a specific version of this module installed that you're using or whatnot. So sometimes you actually have to write stuff in the lowest common denominator, and writing portable warm shell syntax without all that bash gunk that is loaded on top of it can be actually very, very useful. So, when you do that, you want to try to actually increase your performance. And you can write efficient shell code that is elegant and easy to read. And one of the things I always say, well, you have to avoid file I/O. Again, that is something I always tell my students when they're writing their programs. I find it interesting to see how students treat code, because those are the people who don't have much experience, and those will be like the first biggest mistakes you see. But they get ingrained, and if nobody points them out, they're going to continue them once they're professionals. So most of the time, people run one command, redirect stuff to a file. Then they run the second command with the second file as input. And the third one, and so on and so on. Anytime you do file I/O, you are wasting a lot of performance. It takes a lot of time for you to actually write to the disk and read from the disk, and then you have to clean up your temporary files, you have to deal with permission denied on the temporary files, creation of temporary files, and so on and so on. It's not pretty effective. Avoid, where possible, the useless use of the various commands. And this is interesting because when you're running interactively, you actually can do a number of things that nobody cares. But if you put them into a script and you run it frequently with lots of inputs, you have to be a little bit more discerning about what you do. So, use built-ins when you can. If you have a built-in, then you don't need to have another four and you don't have to actually waste the performance there. Avoid the buildings when it makes sense. So for example, in the case of IFS and Redo, we've noticed that this was a lot less performance than actually shelling out or forking another process. Avoid spawning subshells. Subshells are always expensive. So they actually require you one additional avoid, and then for a pipeline they have to have one more for the actual pipeline. In general, you need to know which tools you use to perform the task. And this is the trickiest part, because you have all these things that say, oh, useless use of this, but sometimes it's actually perfectly fine to do, other times it's not. So, how do we know which tool really performs well? It's a very simple answer. we measure all of the things. If you are running any kind of shell script, and you have an input sample, most of the time people have a minuscule input sample. They run something on 10 lines, on 20 lines, that is not enough. Run it on a gigabyte size file and see how it performs. Measure it. One of the examples I recently ran into is I was like, okay, I want to find out how many HTTP standard codes I get in this, you know, Apache web log. So I want to know how many successful they were. Successful return calls are 200 or 2xx, more precisely, so let's look for them. So we said, okay, substitute whatever comes up to get HTTP, replace it with a number, we grab out only the ones that start with a 2, no ones are successful, and then we count them. This is one way to do it. Well, it's a useless use of WC. We don't actually need this. We can then grab to it. Grab processes and already can count this stuff. Or, if it's a useless use of search, then we can actually do it with R, as you've seen before. We can actually program something, write an expression, count the numbers, at the very end, print them out. Different variations of the same thing. So which one do we use? Let's find out. We time it, we check the set, on a fairly large file, I forget how big it is, but then I said, whenever I test something, I'm going to go with the input file to really, really large, and at least a gigabyte in input size of text file. So let's talk about 4 minutes, which is quite a long time. We ran this with Arc. Arc ran in a little bit over 1 minute. Yes?
You made sure to flush the buffer cache on the screen, right?
Yes. Now that is a very valid example. It's a question of how you measure accuracy. If you are reading the same input file twice, then you are obviously buffer cache to actually provide a certain performance benefit, but not quite this kind of performance. But that is absolutely valid. How about this one? Why don't we just pull out Pro? Well, we had Arc, we had Sed. Pro, surely you just look at this. Arc is linked against the C library and the NAS library. Sed is only linked against C library. Pro is linked against all sorts of stuff. Let Pro alone, if you look at it, how gigantic it is. Look at this. We look at this over here, we find, okay, Pro, the executable is small, but it has to load Let Pro, which is fairly big. We have Arc, and we have Sed. You would have expected us looking at this, maybe Sed would be faster. But we know Sed wasn't faster. Arc was faster than Sed. And so we measure all the things. And once we measure all the things, we realize, look at this, Perl did in 22 seconds what Arc did in 1 minute and what Sed did in 4 minutes. As much as I am not a fan of Perl in general, sometimes it's the right tool. You know what Perl is really good at? Perl is really good at performing regular expressions across its text input. That is a useful use of Perl. We had a 92% performance increase compared to Sed and a 65% in performance increase over Sed, over Arc in this case. Measure all the things. But sometimes you have to be willing to take a penalty. In my first example, on the very first slide, we said, hey, this is me. Grab something on a password, cut it, and think of its fields. Well, we had another one already. We said, oh, this is silly, this should be done with this use of grep. We could do this with Arc, something like this, where we assign a variable, and then we do a comparison, which of course is awful, and could be easier written like this. Where you set this line like that, we notice the difference in coding over here. If you're coding double quotes, variables are extended, single quotes they are not. Or, in the second field, we have the useless use of WC, we said, and we said print this like this. But seriously, the performance that you're gaining here is computer performance. What you're using is human performance. Human performance is much, much more important than computer performance. Humans need to be able to read this and to debug this and to understand this. And they can't do it if it looks convoluted like that. Which is why I say the actual ability counts in this case, and I would prefer the first one or the odd one, the last one, any time, in particular the second example, the useless use of cat into WC any time over this R command, I assume, because it just reads much easier. The prime directive when you're programming in general, or in any kind of systems engineering task, is to keep it simple, students, right? We all know, keep it simple. If you keep things simple, they're easier to maintain and retain. Which brings us to what is known as the Jersey approach to software engineering. It is known as the Jersey approach, named after Bell Labs, where all these wonderful things that we take for granted come from. It is named the Jersey approach in contrast to the MIT approach, which counts as everything has to be correct. The Jersey approach says, no, it has to be simple first and foremost. That is the single most important aspect of the tool that you're writing. Make things simple. And if you look at the way that Unix is written, you will find that the scopes. Set, op, web, all these tools are very, very simple in the way that they perform actions, the input they expect, the output they produce, and what you can do with them. But once you have these simple tools, you can combine them in a surprising way. The order of importance is simplicity is the most important. Correctness is only slightly more better to be simple than correct. It is permissible to not behave 100% correct and instead be simple. There are a number of examples in the English world that consider this. If you look at the way that FileIO is done, for example, if you know about interrupted system calls, sometimes your process may be swapped out of memory when you don't expect it. So you are doing something, and then your agent is swapped out, and then you want to return to your program. There's only a small number of system calls that are so-called re-entry system calls, where you're guaranteed to be able to perform the action after you've lost your cycle on the CPU. The correct way to do this was to have more of them be re-entry than everything keeps state. But it's much, much more complicated to do so. So the designer of Unix chose to go the simple way of just saying, hey, if I lose my turn and I come back, I'm just going to return a specific error code, be in turn, and then you just have to loop over it again, and you have to figure it out for yourself. Which makes it a little bit more difficult for the reader to do this, but the implementation itself is simpler and the interface is more consistent. So sometimes, even correctness may take a certain step to simplicity. Consistency and completeness follow likewise, that is saying things have to be most of all simple to use and not to be overly complicated and the other things will follow. To illustrate, remember how a web server used to work? Back in the good old days when we had used it, it was so nice. The client would go and say, knock knock, I'd like to get the contents of this file piece. And there you have it. And the server would go, well certainly, here you go. And effectively would do a cat of the file into the socket that's connected to it, more or less. Yet, that was how web servers used to work. Troubleshooting a web server was really easy. You could look on the file system if the file exists, for example, if it was readable, etc., etc. You know how web servers work nowadays? Hello, I'd like to get the contents of this file in this particular server, please. So you have an HTTP 1.1 request, and you name the server. And the server says something like, I'm sorry, Node.js just crashed. Of course it doesn't say that, it just says internal server error 500. Okay, so you go, wait, Node.js? I thought you said you're an Apache server. Well, sure, I'm an Apache server, but I have to do this busy simple less compilation, which I hand off to Node.js because it's much faster than Rhino. Rhino? Rhino is a JavaScript implementation, Rhino Luna, which runs in Java. So you are actually running JavaScript in Java? Well, sure, I'm a Tomcat server. Tomcat servers are wonderful. Things take only like 5 minutes to start up and 7 to shut down or something like this. Even though it returns right away and says, yes, I'm ready. No, you're not. You're just lying to me. So I am talking to Tomcat, the HTTP connector, which sends my HTTP request to the Catalina Service container, which looks up stuff in various sorts of databases, trigger sections also in the message broker, hands off the last compilation off to Node.js. Wait, what? Less? What is less? Less is a cascading style sheet translator. They call it compilation, it's not really compilation. You just, you know, rewrite one language into another language. Why don't you just drop the plain old CSS? Now don't be silly. All problems in computer science can be solved by another level of innovation. But where was I? Alright, which heads of the last compilation to Node.js, which just crashed? to which the client says, oh, my head hurts, how would we get here? This is a real example of starting content. HTTP is no longer the simple thing that you can look at a file, see what happens. You have all sorts of new interactions and things, and everything is dynamic, and it's really difficult to keep track of. What? Yes?
It's funny, the east and the west are perpendicular to each other instead of opposite.
Yes, I know. It's like,
it really illustrates what you said.
How did we get here? How did we end up like this? Well, you may know this quote, right? All problems in computer science can be solved by another level of interaction. Well, let's talk about layers. Layers are bad when all they do provide is indirection obfuscation and increased complexity. So you eventually end up with too many layers. And this example that I just gave is, we had a web server talking to in Java to a JavaScript implementation, forking off another kind of implementation of web server to process style sheet processing, and eventually something broke in between because the communication of the message broke or turned down or something. The more layers of indirections you have, the more complex the problem becomes, and the more difficult it is to keep state. Layers can be good. Layers are very, very good, for example, they provide security. Security is a lot like an onion. It has to be layered, and the more layers you peel off, the more it stinks, and it makes you cry. And it makes you cry, exactly. That is how security works. You have to have multiple layers of security, so that not when one thing falls down, you're exposed. Like the hard OS shell with a squishy inside is not something that works very well. So layers can be really good. They're really good, but what they do is provide abstraction. Because even though we have multiple layers, for example, in the OSI model, these make things still simpler at the end of the day. Because the higher level layer does not have to care about what the lower level is. You just get a packet, you just send it on the stack, and whatever the lower level made you is none of your concern. Things become simpler. And of course, layers are wonderful if they make things taste better. As long as good example. So complexity is the end. Complexity is really what I have always been going against. When I'm talking about these shell things, these three little things that seem like, oh, this is just some geek rambling on about performance. No, it's about complexity. How does software become simpler, which makes it more easy to maintain, which makes it easier to have other people maintain it, to write it, to enhance it, and to find bugs in it. Complexity is the enemy. It comes in two different flavors. You have something called essential complexity, which is something you cannot control. Sometimes you have a problem, and a certain problem has inherent complexity. There's no way that you can solve something in less than X or in a different way. For example, the HTTP server has at some point get the contents from a file and get them over the network to the client. Those are certain limitations that you cannot make simpler. However, there's a second thing which is known as accidental complexity. Accidental complexity, and this is important, is not something that is introduced by people who are nefarious and just do it for the fun of it. You have these tools that grow and people mean well, they try to optimize it, they're trying to make things better. But what they do is they add another layer over it sometimes. Sometimes they add just a new thing into it, which means you have more access points, you have more entry points into your system. You may have more different output results possibilities. So you actually have more things that interact that makes things more complex. Making it dynamic adds complexity. A simple web server, a static web server, is fairly simple, and it's easy to write and it's easy to debug. A dynamic one is very, very complex and very, very hard. And some of them are even complicated, which is even worse. The real problem is that software complexity increases non-linearly, frequently exponentially. If you have a component and you get a second component, a second communications endpoint to it, you no longer have an external tool, you may have four, because you actually count for every possibility of what goes in where and what breaks down where. If you talk about virtualization, for example, adds a whole new layer to storage. Up until now, you had hardware, you had a disk drive, there was a file system on top of it, and you knew the 5 to 6 different things that would go wrong, right? You know, okay, file system tuning, the file system might be corrupted, it might not be talking to the kernel to the actual layer and figure it down, the bus may have a hardware error, and then 5 things approximately. Nowadays, The hardware is up in the cloud over there, and the server might be down, the network might be down, and God knows what else might be going on, right? So all of a sudden, we have a much larger number of problem points. Complexity increases non-linearly, which means just because you think, oh, I'm getting this one simple thing to this, may actually make it significantly more complex than you thought it would. All of this is much, much better described and explained in this wonderful book called The Mythical Manuals, which is only about 40 years old or so, and we still haven't learned the lessons from this book. Please go buy that book. It's really, really useful. All right, you say, the same could be said about, for example, useless use of message queues. Now, message queues, we currently have all sorts of wonderful home software that has message queues, but we also used to have System 5 message queues, right? System 5 IPC. I was unable to come up with a single widely used application that still uses System 5 IPC. I could not even come up with a single example. Maybe message queues are not so great. All sorts of different formats that we have nowadays, right? You have JSON, which is actually fairly okay in my world, but XML, all these markup languages, all are fairly awful. They all add more complexity. Yes, they also allow you to do certain things more efficiently if you happen to have the right tool. If you happen to have this module that parses this particular version of XML, then yes, you get a hash of all the values, which is great. But if you don't, and you try to actually process it, regular text processing tools, good luck to you.
You can, I mean, I'm going to be showing you some other kind of bugs.
Right, if you happen to have XML.
Okay.
Right, so the Unix world has always favored very simple text formats that are text streams, line-oriented input sets. That is something that is universally easy to process, not only by machines, but more importantly, by the humans. Because if you are trying to think your way through an XML structure, it is much more difficult than thinking your way through a line-oriented field-separated input list that you have.
Well, if you have enough to write towers to the model, except you will have enough to write XML.
Yes, but it wouldn't make it a good idea. Just like writing towers to one way is not necessarily a good idea.
Could I do buffers?
Excuse me?
Has anyone used Google Buffers?
Google Buffers?
Vertical Buffers.
No,
I haven't. It's actually more efficient than it's
a binary format.
Yeah.
Yeah, so another example is, I don't know if any of you use Windows a lot. I don't. I haven't used Windows in pages. But I know, out of theory, that the Windows PowerShell passes objects between pipelines, which I thought is really, really interesting. Because it means between two commands, you can pass more than just certain input string. You can pass properties of an object, which is wonderful. Until, of course, the person who wrote tool one chose not to expose certain things about itself, right? So you're relying on the writer of the first tool to expose everything and think of every possible use case. The Unix runs it the other way around. They say, I could use this, and however it may be used later on, well, we'll figure it out when we get there. People may later on use this in a different way that I cannot predict right now. Here's another one. The useless use of DSL, domain-specific languages. I don't know if any of you know Greenspan's 10th rule of programming. It was like this. Any sufficiently complicated C or Fortran program contains an ad hoc, informally specified, byte-written, slow implementation of half a common list.
Fetch mail?
No. Fetch mail, well, fetch mail eventually goes back to the philosophy that any tool will eventually evolve to also send and receive mail, which is a second language. This is the 10th rule of programming, but for the Greenspan, there were no other 9, it just chose the 10th. What it means is that people, when they try to solve problems, they frequently end up writing their own domain-specific language that describes their particular problem, right? So they say, oh, we have this thing that has an object which contains this kind of property, and the configuration file must represent that by writing it in this language. And then you have to write a parser for this particular configuration file format. And then you go and say, oh, but we can do this in XML and so on. And that's the Beachman declared early on that frequently what happens is that these domain-specific languages grow more and more complex until they can do all sorts of things, just not as well as certain other languages. And finally, of course, useless use of NoSQL and Cassandra and Jumbo and all these other new and shiny things, right? There's not a single conference call that you see that does not include at least two of those three words or more. It is what people do. You see Facebook doing it, and you see Twitter doing that, and all these things. But what's interesting is they also still do all the old stuff underneath somewhere, right? All these people who did NoSQL and MongoDB and whatnot, they also still have a MySQL DB sitting somewhere doing just regular SQL. So you can say this about a lot of things. You can say this about pretty much anything that comes up. To which I say, precisely. That is exactly my point. We have this added complexity in almost all of the things that we're doing. And we could be doing things a whole lot simpler. Which is exactly what I will be talking about in velocity next time, which is why you get in this part of the talk, because we can see it goes into that direction. Anyway, worse is better. It's the Jersey philosophy of software development, which states, as we said, it bears repeating, that simplicity is the most important thing. Design must be simple, both in the implementation and interface. It is more important for the implementation to be simple than the interface. Simplicity is the most important consideration of the design. If you are running software, if you create a new tool, even if the tool is just for you, keep it simple. Because you don't know who else will use it later on. You may say, oh, this tool is just for me. But people in your company will say, oh, let me use that. And they will use it in ways that you cannot predict. And the only way a new tool will be really useful for other people is if it has well-defined, simple interfaces, is simple to debug, simple to understand where the process flow goes and what the connection elements are. Nevertheless, it is no silver bullet, which is another essay by Fred Brooks, which also relates to the commandments, and you should all read that too. Meaning, you cannot solve all problems with one specific thing. Sometimes complexity is unavoidable, so you can't do anything about it. Even if you try to make it simpler, you cannot solve anything about it. You just have to be aware of it. And it's a fairly good approach. Anyway, so what's the simplest use of time? I don't know. But boo complexity, hooray simplicity, and hooray DR.